Now, I'm going to do something that may seem a little redundant to you, but I'm going to do it because I want to illustrate to you the importance in priesthood of the use of the voice. It is very important for you to learn how to use and project your voice. I'm going to read parts of this handbook to you that you can very well just read by yourself. But you're going to get it. It's going to make an impact upon you through my voice that it doesn't make through your eyes. There's a very powerful force that comes through the ears. The ears are an occult birth canal. Sound and audible sound is a very powerful thing that's been used in liturgy for ages. And one of the things I'm going to say to you briefly and tell you a little bit about is intoning and chanting and harmonic chanting. I'm going to read to you from the section on daily morning and evening practices and the importance of regularity and perseverance. Just as a musician cannot become a great performer unless he invests hours of regular, faithful, daily practice on the instrument, so a neophyte cannot develop in priesthood without regular, rhythmic, perseverant spiritual practice. Unlike a musical instrument, the instrument of priesthood is internal. It is the mind, heart, soul, and character of the priest that must be focalized, exercised, and trained in daily practice. Now, the best time to practice is when it seems most difficult, when there is external distraction, psychic attack, social pressure, or lack of any motivation to sit and do your practice. Under those conditions, you can make far more progress than when everything comes easily and fluently. If you persevere and make your best effort to focus, concentrate, and achieve the goals of the practice sincerely and wholeheartedly. But if you merely go through the motions of the practice at these times, very little is achieved. It is important to do each practice with full presence. Now, each daily practice consists of two parts. The first might be called prayer, but it is really a process of interior striving, uplifting your mind and heart for attunement with divine reality. It is a process of contacting your own central point of stillness, or what is known in Buddhism as calm abiding, and opening yourself to greater spiritual communion and the experience of inner light. It begins with prayer and words, but ends in silence. The second part is one of the two aspects of that same communion with divine reality. In the morning, we meditate because the mind is relatively quiet, having recently awakened from sleep. Meditation is a non-verbal or non-discursive abiding in expanded consciousness through a focus. In the case of temple meditation, a focus on holy white light. In the evening, we contemplate because the mind has been filled to overflowing with the events of the day. Contemplation is a calm, objective observing of ourselves for the purpose of evaluating what and how we have performed spiritually throughout the day. It is non-judgmental. During other parts of the day, private communion with divine reality alternates between meditation and contemplation, depending upon the needs of the day. The daily practices must be regular and rhythmic, because each day a small gain is achieved, but it is diminished or lost by each day of neglect. So theoretically, if we practice only once every other day, we would have a net progress close to zero. However, even if we practice poorly but do it regularly, we'd make some progress. So how much more if we practice regularly and try to make each session perfect? This is not to say that spiritual practices perfect the souls of humanity. What perfects the soul of each person is his or her response to the tests and trials experienced in the furnaces and fires of daily life. How does he or she deal with an enemy? How does she handle a terrible loss? The point of spiritual practice is to equip each of us with interior spiritual resources to meet our challenges in daily life so that we may overcome, quote, the world, the flesh, and the devil. This is the, quote, shadow boxing spoken of by Paul to prepare us for the true battles of life. Now, it's vital to persevere in daily spiritual practice because, if done properly, it prepares us to deal creatively with whatever life throws at us. If we practice regularly and rhythmically, we establish a powerful vibration that carries us through even the most difficult and terrible illnesses, attacks, losses, and calamities. Or did you hope that spirituality would protect us against terrible illnesses, attacks, losses, and calamities? Absolutely not. That is why Peter told his hearers not to think it strange when all sorts of calamities befell them. If anything, moving closer to God exposes us, makes us more vulnerable. It shines light on the dark places inside us we'd rather not see and have to face. It develops higher sensitivities in us that enlarge our capacities for pain as well as for pleasure. Never forget that the final outcome of the life of Jesus was, to the world, absolute humiliation and crucifixion as a social criminal. But to the enlightened eyes of the faithful, the final result was that miraculous phenomenon called resurrection, which confirms the spiritual wisdom of all ages and points to a humanity that can transcend itself and become more than human. The Master Jesus was the unique monogenes, or royal firstborn, of the new humanity that each of us strives to manifest. "You shall do even greater things," said the Master, who pointed ahead to a coming messianic age, the same expectation that contemporary Jews still await and that Christian doctrine has distorted into the doctrine of the second coming of Jesus. Spirituality builds a greater soul that is able to bear more sorrow and hold more joy than is possible for ordinary souls. Each of us experiences a time and a season for everything, positive and negative. But though we may be forced to drink even more bitter dregs than we think we can bear, we are also able to sip a far sweeter and more fragrant wine than those who have not yet awakened to the life of spirit. So persist in daily practice and bring into your daily life the tools, powers, energies, and equipment that daily spiritual practice develops in you. Only in this way can you make progress in priesthood. Now, that whole section that I wrote on the importance of the regularity of daily practice was something that you could see with your eyes, and it can kind of pass through you, and you can kind of wander as you read it, and you can say, oh, it's a part of lots of words here. But when I speak it to you, and I emphasize the words, and I inflect the words, and I show you what's important, my pace speeds up over something and slows down over something. And when the tone of my voice goes up and it comes back down again, the pitch of the voice changes. There are subtle things being qualified by the voice when this happens. The voice is spoken on a tone, a generating tone, and that tone generates overtones according to what vowel you are qualifying with your mouth when you speak it. Listen to this sound. You'll hear that there are overtones, there are harmonics in what I speak. If I say a word with an E, I am qualifying a high harmonic. With an O, I'm qualifying a low harmonic on the same tone. These are subtle effects. These are subtle things that affect the energy balance of our system. And when we're doing spiritual work, as we do in the Mass, and we are intoning words in the Mass or in the Eucharist, how we intone is terribly important. You've all been to services, Jewish or Christian or some other sort, where people sing or they chant. Onward, Christian soldiers marching. You know, very, very wimpy stuff. People put out no diaphragm, no projection, no conviction in what they're doing. In priesthood, you put out not just words, you put out energy. You are not putting out discursive thoughts and ideas so much as you are putting out energy and form. So you have to find a tone that works well for you when you work in liturgy. And I have a tape that I have made for you to help you with this. But when you do this, your voice has to be strong and powerful. You have to visualize it as coming up from the solar plexus, the diaphragm, through the heart, qualifying the energy of the heart, through the throat, and out the mouth. Shema Israel. It has to be powerful. It can't be Shema Israel. It can't be we lift up our hearts. It has to be we lift up our hearts. And that is how that energy is transmitted to people in a congregation. It's not just being loud. It's being intense and focused. And this is one of the things you have to learn about liturgics. Your motions and the sounds that you make convey to people an energy. And when you are conveying that energy, you are more powerful than any evangelical preacher standing up and hypnotizing people with his words. You are bringing through the high divine creative forces that work in liturgy and work in the Mass. And these are forces that you will also use to learn in priesthood, not just in the liturgy, the Eucharist, or in the Shabbat Seder, but in the marriage ceremony and in a funeral and of the other very important sacraments that we will give you and teach you how to use. So your voice is important. You will notice that the message that I got through by telling you through my voice about the importance of daily rhythmic committed and daily practice that is perseverant and that is especially effective at times when you least want to do it and when you have most of the currents forcing against you to stop you from doing it, that's when you make the most progress. It reminds me of a story my teacher, Mother Jenny, told me of a vision she had of one of her teachers who was an Indian maiden. And she saw a picture of her Indian maiden paddling her canoe upstream against the current, and she asked her why she was doing that, and she says, because it makes the face shine and the spirit strong. And that is what you must understand and what you must do when you do practice. Practice is practice. It's not real life. There's a wonderful story the Dalai Lama tells of a man who comes to an ancient Indian temple where there is a person sitting in meditation. And he walks up and says, what are you doing? And the fellow says, I am meditating to develop my powers of tolerance and overcome my anger. And so the fellow says, well, tell me about this. And the fellow says, well, I sit here and meditate on learning how to be calm and serene and not to be irritable. And he says, well, can you tell me more what it's like? And the fellow says, well, actually, I'd like to be left alone. Can you please go away? And the fellow says, well, but I want to learn from you. Tell me. And this goes on, and finally the fellow gets very angry and starts yelling at the other guy and chases him all around the temple. And the Dalai Lama points out that the time when that person could have really learned tolerance and could have learned to overcome his temper was when the fellow was irritating him, when the fellow was coming up and bugging him. That's when he really had his practice. That's when he had his practice to overcome these things. Sitting in meditation is not the way you practice things like that. You practice them in life. Life is like an alchemical retort, and we are like the raw materials of alchemy that are transformed in the retorts and the vessels of our environment. And how we respond to these things is very important, whether we identify ourselves with the dross or the ash, or we identify ourselves with the gold that melts and is distilled from the raw ore. And the way we respond to the things that seem to happen to us in life, the way we respond to others, this is all part of our own building of our character, soul building. Because we are as souls in a state of evolution. Human souls, when they first appear and they're very young, are just barely holding themselves together. They're like a new building that's been put together by a not very skillful architect. And in order to test us, we have to go through the earthquakes. We have to experience the tremendous disturbances that come. And then we see where our weaknesses are, and then we repair and we build and we make ourselves better and stronger. And that is why we have these things in life. It's not to hurt us or torment us. It's to help us. We have to be able to take the experiences we have in life, and we have to use them to help ourselves become stronger on interior levels, in our character and in our attitudes towards people. And so the progress of the soul, the journey of the soul through life, is a journey of pleasure and of pain. And as we become more sensitive, as we exercise our priesthood, as we exercise divine attunement, we also will become more sensitive to irritation. We will become more sensitive to the things that can feel bad as well as the things that feel good. Whereas we only were like a musical instrument that could play one octave before, pretty soon we develop two octaves. We have the lows and we have the highs. We can go into great depressions. The most classic of these is the Dark Night of the Soul. But we can also go into great ecstasies, far beyond what normal human beings can experience. And the one comes with the other. We deepen our cups. We deepen our chalice. We hold more and more, and we can hold the nectars, and we can hold the bitter drinks as well. So both are needed. We have 2 feet. We have a left foot and a right foot. Otherwise, we can't get anywhere on 1 foot. So we can't expect to have nothing but joy and glory and health and beauty in our lives. We need and we have the other things that happen. And many times it overwhelms us. But spiritual practice gives us a balance. It gives us a central point. Because it's at that central point, when we go back to our center, to our heart, we contact God and the divine in us and through us. That is what is healing for us. That is what is strengthening. And that is what it is that causes our soul to evolve into stronger, more integrated, more serviceable, and a higher character kind of a building, if we think of it as a soul, as a building. Now, Willa has given you some very important exercises. Willa spent 8 years in Indonesia with a great master of what was called Silat, which is a martial art. And she is one of the very few women that have been inducted as an inheritor of the ancient Chinese Shaolin lineage. And she was entrusted by her teacher with a special form of the martial arts, which uses mudra, motion, and the geometry of motion, etc., to contact subtle forces within the body. And these were the healing motions, the healing movements. He gave them to no one else. She is the only one that has them and knows them now. Other people have died, and she was specifically designated for this, and her master died very tragically in an automobile accident at the age of 60. He had the body of a man who was 30 by doing these exercises, these ancient Chinese exercises, and those that he had created himself because he was a master. And Willa imparts to you in the mind-body temple three of these exercises. And you must take them very seriously. I want to tell you that for the last 3 years, I've been doing the exercises that she's given me, and they have made a tremendous difference in my health. And I am very aware of many other esoteric techniques and keeping myself healthy and alive as I grow older. I'm approaching 60 years old, and most people think I'm about 40 when they look at me. And keeping myself healthy and off of having to take blood pressure medications and things like this. And with the wonderful things that she's given to me, and especially some of these movements, it's made a wonderful difference for me. It will for you too. Silat is a martial art, but it knows very many esoteric things about motion and mudra. So I would very much encourage you to try those. You are not required to do them. And she also has a tape that she will you will receive that you should listen to on basic tenets of what health of mind and body is. And she's going to speak about the Chinese concept of the inner still point. And that is what we mean when we talk about going into meditation, meditation in the light, in the heart. And that is the place that you go to, that non-discursive place in you that attunes you and that heals you and from which inspiration flows. And that is where the prophets went. And that is where all the great mystics who really were in contact with higher communion and with divine communion, that's where they went. And you will need to learn how to develop these spiritual resources within yourself. The meditation practice that I'm giving you starts out with some experiments for you to do to see what kind of mind you have. You actually learn where you're distracted the most. And in the mode of what distracts you the most, you learn the best way to approach meditation. Contemplation is looking at yourself from a place almost outside of yourself. Krishnamurti taught a very simple but very effective thing. He said, if you want to change bad habits you have, a bad temper, ways you respond with cowardice or with nastiness or anything like this in yourself, don't do it with a lot of self-judgment. Just watch yourself going through your little number when you're doing it without any judgment, and just watch yourself. Let it be seen. Let yourself see yourself doing this. Let yourself see yourself getting angry or yelling at someone or getting fearful or getting bowing down to someone who is running over you with a steamroller or something. Whatever it is, watch yourself. And then think about how you would like to be. And then when this circumstance comes up again, you will find you have a little more control over it. And eventually, you will change. You will change yourself, not by judgment, but just by observation, by dispassionate, non-judgmental observation. And this is what contemplation is. You contemplate, you go into your higher mind, you look at yourself as though you were a child and you were the parent. You look at yourself as a child from the standpoint of your parent, your higher nature, your higher self. And you see what you're doing. You make it conscious. You bring it up from the subconscious and the unconscious, and you make it conscious. And that allows you the processes, your body, your mind, your soul will naturally start to get a hold on this and do things. But you can't change things in yourself by kicking against them. by trying to overcome them with force of will and things like that. You can do that, but you will build some very bad consequences that way. So whether you want to gain control over some bad habit, like smoking cigarettes or eating the wrong kinds of foods or whatever you want to do, contemplation is a way of dealing with this. You just look at what you've done during the day. Make yourself aware of it. Because the way that people continue doing things they really don't want to do is they just avoid it. The way the dark forces work is by ignorance. They work by hiding. They work by in yourself by having you look away from what you don't like and what you don't want to see and just not think about it. But here you're going to shine the light on it. You're going to look at it. This, by the way, is very similar to some things that Paul said about crucifixion. He said, crucify the old nature. That means hold it up. Put it up in the light. Hold it up in public to yourself. Make it known to yourself. So that's what contemplation does. You just look at it. You don't have to do anything hard. Just look at it. See it for what it is. The next time the situation comes up, you will find that you will have a handle on it. Not maybe the first time or the second or the third time, but you will be on a gradual evolution where eventually you will be able to handle it by making it conscious. And that's what contemplation does. Meditation attunes you in the morning. It attunes you when you come out of sleep and when your mind has not been murkied and muddied by life that day yet. It's like a mountain stream that's still crystalline. But at the end of the day, your mind is like an old slow river that's full of everybody's sewage. So you want to do your meditation in the morning when your mind is crystalline, and you want to do it before you get involved in anything else. You want to do your meditation at the end of the day and look back upon everything you've done dispassionately, not with guilt, not with self-condemnation, because that is not useful. That is absolutely unuseful. And if you can learn to be non-judgmental with yourself, that's the greatest exercise for learning to become non-judgmental with other people. So that practice of contemplation is very important. The practice of meditation is important. And keeping a journal of what insights you might have, even if you just say, this morning I meditated for 5 minutes, I saw a couple of little flickers of light, I felt peaceful. That's all you need to say. And in your journal, in your contemplation, you might say, I didn't really think of anything or see anything that I feel badly about or I want to change today. That's a little bit dangerous, but you still might have those days. But you want to not also say, oh, I had a bad thought at 12:05 and I did this and I did that. You don't want to get neurotic about it. But whatever you put down in your spiritual journal, it doesn't have to be just experiences you had at that time. It can be thoughts, ideas that come into your mind during the day that are spiritual. You might write for an entry in your spiritual journal, gee, I see how water comes up out of the ocean, is distilled in clouds and rains on the mountains, and as snow and melts and comes down in rivulets and goes through rivers and finally passes out to the ocean again in a great cycle. And I see this is like the cycle of incarnation of souls or something like that. And if you have some kind of idea like that that comes through, that's a beautiful thing to put. So your spiritual journal is not supposed to be just something of self-criticism or a record of what you saw when your eyes were closed. It's also a record of thoughts and ideas that move along. So I would expect an entry for each day for the 6 months of this period. And this is a wonderful exercise. You don't have to do it beyond the diaconate, but it is a wonderful exercise, and you will treasure this in the future. I've done this exercise many, 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 many years ago, and I still have my journal from it, and it was very significant for me. Okay, well, this is your introduction to the studies, and I think you will find that there is a great deal that comes to you through this, no matter what your preparation has been. And I want to welcome you once more into the home temple. Thank you.